This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Wheeler Centre. My name is Chris Flynn. I'm a journalist and author of a couple of novels. I will perhaps have another one coming out next year. I'm currently arguing about that. I'm also an animal welfare officer at the RSPCA a few days a week, just to get me out of the house. I work a couple of days in the cattery. I know this sounds like I'm making it up, but I literally take care of sick and injured cats and kittens.
Yay. Yes, what a good man.
And I think we'll call it a night. That's as good as it gets. I want to acknowledge that we're meeting today on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. Pay my respects to their elders, past and present. Now, tonight's guests are Meg and Tom Keneally. Tom, as you may know, has written 17 books of non-fiction, by my count, and 36 novels, if that's correct. So he's slowly rising up the ladder. He's won the Man Booker Prize and the Miles Franklin twice. I know you all think of him as an Australian, but I don't really. I think of him as the world's greatest living Irish writer. Meg, his daughter, has worked as a journalist in Dublin and Australia, and then she spent a decade in the evil corporate world before her father dragged her kicking and screaming into the lucrative life of a novelist. She's also a scuba diving instructor, which is your classic weird author bio stuff. In fact, I believe you're heading off at 2 a.m. tomorrow morning to go on...
Not to go diving, but to do some evil corporate stuff, unfortunately, at 2 a.m.
At 2 a.m.?
Yeah, no, that's why it's evil.
This sounds very evil. Together, they've written two novels, The Soldier's Curse and The Unmourned, which are parts one and two of the Montserrat series, which is a very funny and very exciting detective series of sorts, set during the early days of Australian colonial life. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Meg and Tom Keneally.
Thank you.
I've got the books stacked up in my lap. I don't know why, but these are great books. I really love them.
Oh, thank you.
I'm so stoked that there's a series of novels coming out that I can look forward to every year. How many are you intending on doing?
Well, Dad wants to do 12. Right. And I've agreed to it because I want him contractually obliged not to drop off the perch. So, and we have plots for 12.
You do? I was going to ask. That was my next thing. Have you got them all planned out?
Mm-hmm. Some more than others, but we've got a couple of things that we want to happen to the main characters over the arc of the several books, and it's sort of thumbnail sketches for the later ones and detail plots for the ones that we want to write in the next couple of years.
Oh, that's amazing. So I find that really hard to get my head around. That's like planning all 9 seasons of Game of Thrones at once.
Well, it'll probably all change because the most recent one, I'm halfway through the second draft of the third one, which will be out this time next year, and we've already changed murderers 3 times. So just because we have the plots worked out doesn't mean they're going to be worth anything once we get to them.
We have the penal stations worked out.
Yeah, we do have those worked out. We've got the settings worked out.
Because Eastern Australia had plenty of them.
Yes, of course. Mm. And these are based on a story of yours, is that right, that you couldn't get out of your head?
Yes, I was. I've written a number of histories. I'm on volume 4 now hope to finish this year. This is a very confusing era to write about. I felt safer writing about the penal era in Australia, and I was fascinated by theories about crime, that there was a criminal class, for example.
Yes, of course.
And that this was a congenital criminal class, not created by social circumstances, but congenitally criminal. And so to those who believe that, the gentleman convict, the educated convict, was a double class traitor in becoming a criminal himself. And I was looking into the career of James Tucker. James Tucker's crime was that he accused a rich uncle of abuse against children. And the rich uncle charged him or issued a writ for criminal libel. This was something that we don't have now, thank God, where as well as having to pay libel judgments, you also copped a jail term. And he ended up in Australia and did a certain stint in Sydney and Parramatta and was then received a ticket of leave. But his ticket of leave was specific to a region outside Sydney, and he was travelling to Parramatta to meet a woman when he was caught and ended up at Port Macquarie, up the coast of New South Wales. One of the remotest places on the planet at that stage of history. And I felt so sorry for him, this educated bloke who was probably right about his uncle, who was transported for criminal libel and who was subject to the narkiness of Tory officials who just wanted to punish him every time he stepped out of line. And he ended up dying in Liverpool Insane Asylum in Sydney. And so I was attracted to the idea of speaking up for the gentlemen convicts. But then the fact that I'm a prole myself made me want to put a balancing prole in the story, and that's where Mrs. Mulrooney came from. Why don't you talk about her, Meg?
Oh, well, Mrs. Mulrooney is the real brains behind the operation. She's an illiterate Irish housekeeper who is incredibly perceptive, as people on the margins often are. They're hanging out on the edges and observing. So she is the one who really solves the crime, despite the fact that Montserrat takes the credit for it. And I really loved writing her, particularly as... it's not explicitly stated in the books, but she's 55 in the first book. And I think an older female character who's not there to be anyone's love interest, who's not there to be anyone's mother, who's not there to, you know, be a supporting Mrs. Hudson-style character. For all that she is a housekeeper, she's a driver of the action. And I really, you know, have always enjoyed that yin and yang aspect, these two characters.
Yeah, I was almost... at one point thinking of her as the Dr. Watson to Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
But I actually think she's a bit more than that, because she can solve, she can think about what's going on in a very different way to Montserrat.
Mm. Yes.
She has the benefit of not being educated.
Mm, that's right. And also the benefit of being invisible.
Mm.
Because she's a housekeeper, and those who sort of matter in colonial society, to them, she's part of the furniture who puts tea in front of them and then melts away. So she's able to take... she recognises that there is an advantage to be taken from that and has no compunction about taking it.
These books are set in 1825, that's mm-hmm. right, isn't it? And they're both yep. set within a few months of each other, I noticed, as well.
That's right, yeah. We're going to have two books per Montserrat year, if you know what I mean.
Right.
So the next one that I'm writing at the moment takes place in early 1826, and the one after that will take place in later 1826 and so on. Because we didn't want to, if we really are doing 12, we didn't want Montserrat to be 103 by the time
It's going to be quite a chronicle of the 1820s, though.
Yes, yeah. Well, I mean, it's an interesting time, too, because it's a time when Australia was just in its birth throes as a civil society, emerging from being just a gulag and negotiating with itself about what it wanted to be. So that throws up all sorts of interesting dramatic possibilities.
And starting to develop a progressive politics, at least in one part of the community, too. And, of course, this question of convict and free, it does fascinate us even at this distance. And it is a fascinating issue. And then the other issue, which comes out strongly in the second book, I suppose, is the gender imbalance between female and male, which was only solved by the gold rushes. Only with the gold rushes did we become a balanced society.
Yeah, it was 7-1 men to women.
It was 7-1, the ratio.
Yeah. Mm.
And I guess life for women in the colony, even when they were freed, it wasn't exactly bright. I mean, they didn't really have much in the way of opportunity, did they?
No, no, they didn't. Having said that, there are some women in the broader colony, not so much Parramatta, who did extraordinary things, people like Susanna Holmes and Mary Reby and people of that nature. But generally speaking, yeah, they were the most powerless subset of a very powerless group. And those who survived were incredibly tough.
And then you had some extraordinary women visitors, like who? What was the name of that woman who wrote a journal?
Oh, Charlotte Anley. And she was an acolyte of Elizabeth Fry, who some people may know of. Elizabeth Fry was a prison reformer in England, and she would visit women in Newgate and, you know, attempt to rehabilitate them. And one of her offsiders visited the female factory in Parramatta. And tells the story of, I don't know how many people have heard of Samuel Marsden. He was a hellfire and brimstone preacher. He was also a magistrate, and he was also known as the flogging parson. And he was also on the board of the management committee of the female factory. And he is fictionalised in this book under the name of Horace Bulmer.
Yes.
What's also fictionalised in this book, because the thing about historical fiction is that the stuff that seems the most outlandish is the stuff that actually happened. It's the mundane stuff that you make up. And one thing that Charlotte Anley talks about in her journal is how desperate the convict women were to escape Samuel Marsden's Sunday lectures. And as a result, a significant proportion of them converted to Roman Catholicism so that they didn't have to go. And there was no way I wasn't going to put that in the book. Not a chance.
Well, this second book, The Unmourned, it's set in Parramatta and sort of in and around the female factory, where there has been a murder in the factory, and Montserrat is now employed as a clerk, but he has that sort of Liam Neeson style, a very specific set of skills, where he is set to the task of trying to solve the murder. But there's a time limit on it. And it's a great way to talk about what happened in the female factory. Can you tell us a little bit about what the female factory was?
It was a couple of things. And, it's a testament to how confused the administration was that they were never able to answer that question in 20 words or less. It was a factory in which the women wove and spun and picked oakum and so on. It was an employment agency where people went for assigned convict servants. It was, as Dad says, the site of Australia's first speed dating, where convicts who were about to go bush would drop in and acquire themselves a wife on the way. And it was a place of quite brutal secondary punishment as well as primary punishment as well.
And you have a family link to the female factory, don't you?
My great-great-grandmother, my mum's great-grandmother, was a Limerick girl who stole clothes and received a trip to the female factory for her trouble.
Just a seven-year sentence. You know, it was a bit of I find a bit of a scandal when they transport a girl who's done 2.5 or 3 years in a county jail in Ireland, and she's got a seven-year sentence. She already nearly served half of it, still gets sent to Australia. You've got to think that there was an underlying eugenics thing. They were getting rid of unfit human beings. Of course, the fact, I think the authorities might have thought she was not an unfit human being when her great-grandson flew 90 missions for Bomber Command. But until then, they were outcast women and described as fallen women and depraved women, expected to revert to prostitution upon reattaining liberty. Not everyone thought of them in those terms, but the one side of society did.
I find it highly ironic, though, that the British were deporting what they deemed to be a criminal underclass of people to as far away as they could possibly get them, and setting up a sort of a basic sort of authority systems here.
Yeah.
But then they would just all get their ticket of leave eventually and be part of the society.
And, I think that I do think that there are some parallels to be drawn between our treatment of asylum seekers today, because in both cases you've got a large group of inconvenient people that you just want to basically go away.
Mm.
And so you put them behind a wall, whether it's a wall of sea or a wall of stone or a wall of steel, and then try to forget about them as much as possible. And I think it's possible that the authorities in the UK were so relieved that they didn't have to deal with them anymore, that once their tickets of leave expired, they were quite happy for them to stay out here until there was a fellow called James Moody, who was a pastoralist in Sydney, who went back to the UK, and he would have been a shock jock today. He was the kind of person who said, you know, who today would say, oh, well, of course, single mothers get pregnant just so that they can have the palatial, you yes. know, pension, you know, the just for the welfare. That's what he would have said if he were a modern person. What he was actually saying at the time, in a book he wrote called The Felonry of New South Wales, in which he invented the word felonry, he said, people are committing crimes just so they can be transported. Because
such a glorious life. Right?
Yes, exactly. But it was the case that people could, under certain circumstances, do better here than they could have at home. So the authorities didn't mind leaving people out here to rot when they thought that they actually were rotting. But as soon as they started to actually make good, all of a sudden, no, we can't have that.
Yes, I mean, the progressives, like Governor Burke, an Irish Irish Protestant landlord, progressives like him welcomed the success of the convict class, but not everyone did. It was a very divided society.
Mm. And the but the media, there was a bit of a nascent media out here at that time too.
Yeah, there
and,
was.
And they loved having a go at the female factory as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. There was a riot at the female factory, after which, in the report of which, the women were referred to as Amazonian banditti, which is a badge I would wear with pride personally, but it wasn't intended as a compliment. And there was another article in which the writer said that the women were, I think it was twice as determined in their vicious career as the men. And
yes.
They were all seen as whores and dismissed as such.
So the right was seen as arising from their criminal natures. I'm sure it was a very stroppy riot, but it arose out of a superintendent selling off their supplies and malnourishment amongst the women, and it resulted from a superintendent getting the women to shave each other's heads as a mark of shame, and the women refused to, began to climb the walls and invaded Parramatta.
And shopkeepers would pelt them with goods so that they wouldn't be tempted to come into their shops.
It was one of the early colonial panics over women. We've had many since.
Their children were taken away from them too, weren't they?
At age four, yeah. Hmm. Not quite as brutal as the Cascades female factory in Hobart, where the children were taken at 6 months. But, yeah, at age four they were taken to the orphan school. And I just can't imagine what that must have been like to lose your child at that age. Just must have been...
And where did they take them?
To the orphan school. There were a couple of orphan schools. There was a girls' orphan school right next door to the female factory, essentially, and there was a boys' orphan school a bit of a distance off. But what would happen is they were supposed to... The first-class convicts could visit their children on Sundays.
Because there's different classes of convict as well, isn't
there? That's right.
This is wonderful. There were first, second and third class women.
Yeah,
and they were referred to as first, second and third class.
So if you're a first class woman, you could visit your children on Sundays.
And what identified you as a first class woman?
You'd either just arrived or you had been of exceptional good behaviour. Right. Or
you haven't refused
you had
to have
knocked
sex
back
with
the superintendent. And the quickest way to the third class was to, you know, knock back the superintendent or, you know...
Refuse his advances.
Yes, exactly. But what would quite often happen is the women were supposed to be reunited with their children at the expiry of their sentence, but right. if, like my great-great-grandmother, they were sent as an assigned servant to Cooma, quite often mother and child would never see each other again. That would just be...
ended up at Cooma, which is
she was
well on the
able
way
to take
Victoria
her with her, but
as a assigned convict servant. So these are some of the ironies that afflict the female factory. It's such an important emblem in the history of Australia, in the history of feminism, of the history of the penal system, in the history of relationships between men and women, and to think that as a mass they were condemned as prostitutes, in fact, were the matriarchs of Australia huge numbers. This makes it, to an extent, a holy place, but it's not available. You can't visit it if you're in Parramatta, and yet so much of it is still there. So my old mate, my old Republican mate, Prince Charles... kicked up a fuss about this when he was last here. And I just wish... It seems that because under the rigorous economics of the last 30 years, heritage cannot be quantified as an economic benefit, heritage is being ignored or underused. The fact that... the female factory may enrich the lives of tens of thousands of Australians doesn't mean a lot to our masters. And so it goes uninterpreted, unprotected and uncurated.
And currently under threat from developers. So Dad and I were asked recently to be the patrons of the Parramatta Female Factory Friends, who are... looking, you know, doing everything they can to prevent that. So we both of us quite like stirring the pot a little bit. So we jumped at that with relish, because once it's gone, it's gone.
I was quite surprised to read that at the end in your notes that because I had never heard of it before. I mean, it seems to be an under like. Not really talked about very much.
No, that's right. No. Which is extraordinary when you consider that 1.7 million Australians are descended from convicts who went through the female factory system, and most of those from Parramatta. There were 11 female factories around Australia, but most of them quite small. So of that 1.7 million, the vast majority would be descendants of factory women. I was able to stand where my great-great-grandmother stood because I had special access because I was writing a book. I think it'd be wonderful if the rest of the 1.7 million Australians who were descended from factory women could do the same.
There's a room where women who got their ticket of leave, which licensed them to be employed in their own right, were handed it. Mm. But there's the same places where the women were paraded before the men who wanted wives. And the women had to consent. They had to consent to an interview. If they were half interested, they could sit down with the bloke for an hour or hour and a half, and they could have a coming to terms, speed dating, and decide whether they wanted to marry this stranger and go into the bush and have his children. And this was the beginning of Australian romance, speed dating at the... It's no wonder the only Australian... You Irish guys have great love songs, but the only Australian folk love song is along the lines of the female factory. Pack up your swag, a man talking to a woman, pack up your swag and let's make a push. You know, I mean, that's really sweet talking again. Pack up your swag and let's make a push. I'll take you up the country and show you the bush. I'll be sure you won't get such an offer any day. So come and take possession of the old bullet dray.
Who could possibly refuse?
And, that was the sort of proposal that went on at the female factory, to tell you the truth. And if the female factory hadn't been a marriage bureau and one made it up, it would seem like science fiction, science fiction in the past.
Completely. In fact, a lot of the secondary characters seem like larger than life, but I know that many of them are based on real people as well, such as Socrates McAllister.
Yes, who's based on Hannibal MacArthur, who's the nephew of John MacArthur. And he was a magistrate. He very likely sold sly grog. He fitted up a fellow magistrate on molestation charges, which is also fictionalised in the book. And his uncle, the famous John MacArthur, hated him, didn't think he had much business acumen. So he had a reasonably sized chip on his shoulder, but in the Parramatta firmament, he was one of the stars. Yeah.
There was an enlightened magistrate for whom Montserrat worked while he was still a convict. Mm. And this magistrate is an honest man. And Hannibal Socrates MacAllister fits him up. He puts pressure on his convict woman servant to say that he's raped her and that he's abused her and misused her. And the girl says, no, it's not the truth, to her credit. That happened in real life as well. Yep. And the other night in Sydney, we met a woman, came up and said, do you know the case of
Anne Rumsby Henry Grattan Douglas?
And it was a descendant of the convict woman that they tried to use to destroy this good magistrate in enlightened magistrate, let's say, and because the others had such conflicts of interest. They had, they're on the board of the female factory, they were landowners, they were
a religious minister of religion
who is also a magistrate
and a pastoralist
and a on the committee of the female factory, would have incredible power to coerce and scare people. And
they were siphoning off supplies as well, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. Many of the superintendents were siphoning off supplies. And there was a fair bit of dealing in sly grog as well, rum from questionable sources being sold to shebeens, which is an Irish word which got transplanted into Parramatta, which basically meant an unlicensed drinking house.
Shanty.
And people would just, it would often be someone's home and they would, it would just be known that you could go there and get some cheap grog. And
you don't have to tell me,
They use that word in the southern US, shebeen, too.
Shebeen, I've heard it,
so in you America. Blokes, you spread some words into the larger world. You should have sent more words and less nuns, but they...
We certainly spread something, I'm not sure. All of these real-world facts that you've got worked into this historical fiction, it's great because, and I guess historical fiction's a great way to re-illuminate the facts of history. Mm. And I love the little bit about when the woman, I mean, it's a sad story, the woman who dies because she basically starves to death, she's tied down to the ground.
Yeah, happened. Yeah.
But because she's starving... Mm. She's starving because they're stealing the supplies, the superintendent.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
But what is the result of that?
Well, the result of it is, as you say, she's tethered to the ground with stakes and ropes and dies of starvation. And the administrative response, there's an inquest which finds her death to be a result of hunger and hard treatment. And the administrative response is to increase the rations, not of the women, but of the superintendent, so he wouldn't be tempted to steal. And that's what I mean by, you know, it's the most outlandish stuff that's true. And that actually happened.
And it was partly because the administration was not necessarily callous. They couldn't find anyone else to run the place.
Yeah.
So they had to try to reform this unreformable superintendent.
The other thing I found disturbing about, Montserrat obviously has his ticket of leave finally after having, you know, been in prison in the first book, and he's finally a free man. Mm. But it's hanging over him all the time, like a sort of Damocles, the fact that it can be taken away from him. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that it could be revoked, the status.
Absolutely. No, they were always conditional. And Montserrat's in this story isn't conditional on district, but usually they are. But, you know, it wouldn't take... In the story, Montserrat has thoroughly annoyed two magistrates, both very powerful men, both of whom would love to see him recriminalised, and they can really, if they decide to, just make something up and take his freedom away. So he's got that constant stress of not knowing when he freedom will be taken away. And to make matters worse, these influential men have a preferred perpetrator for the crime that Montserrat is investigating. They are encouraging him to point the finger at a particular convict. He happens to believe she's innocent, and he's falling in love with her. So,
but that's a bit of a theme over both books with Montserrat. He persists in championing the innocent and those who don't have much opportunity, which is, I guess, maybe linked to his own past because he never had much of an opportunity when he was growing up himself.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And he does see... I think because he impersonated a lawyer, because he was doing the work of a lawyer and had the knowledge of a lawyer anyway, I think he's got a rather flexible view of what's just and what's not. Mm. He's got a pragmatic view of what's just and not what not and what's not a legalistic one, according to the laws of the time.
But he's a real moral and an intellectual hero, I think.
Yeah, he's flawed, definitely, I think, don't you?
Yes,
He's at base a good person, I think,
Yes. And I'm aware of the... I mentioned why James Tucker was sent, but you get a case of a... I believe Francis Greenway, certainly Henry Savory, I get them mixed up, who also wrote a novel called Quintus Severton. So he... one of those two, they both, their crimes were not scarlet.
The forged contract?
Yeah. One of those two, Francis Greenway, is accused of forging an architecture contract. He's an architect. Yes, that's right. He's an architect. Mm. Architects are always short of business, or often short of business. And he forged a fake contract, which he then took to a bank and said, look, I've got this big contract coming in. Could you advance me some money? And he was transported, I believe, for 14 years for forging a contract and getting a money advance on false pretenses. We'd all be in Sydney as convict architects and other things if we were... caught for that reason, exaggerating our wealth a bit to a bank.
That's true. I love how Mrs. Mulrooney, who her backstory is explored a lot more in this book, and it made me realise that this is part of a larger story, in that we didn't really hear much backstory from her in the first book, but now we know why she's in Australia and the fact that she was involved with the United Irishmen years prior. Mm-hmm. So did you enjoy going back into Ireland a little bit with
it? Yeah, I loved it. And Mrs. Mulrooney is one of my favourite characters to write anyway. In fact, I'd say she is my favourite character to write. And she is nothing if not a survivor and resourceful. And I've always been fascinated by the 1798 rebellion. It made sense to make her a Wexford woman and put her on Vinegar Hill. And there were
shiploads of those people in Australia, to the point where the governor said that they were a majority. And indeed, they were trying to communicate with Napoleon and say, send a regiment. Just send a regiment and you'll clean up these scandalous, corrupt rum corps, and we can all be French and Irish in Botany Bay in New South Wales. And they did have ambitions of that kind, but The United Irishmen were a noble lot in that they were rather like the American rebels. They modelled themselves on the American rebels.
That's right.
And it was a time when the Protestant gentry and aristocracy and the Catholic punters, you know, foot soldiers, transcended sectarianism,
That's right,
which had always been the blight of Ireland. And in the name of the rights of man, they took on the British Empire and, of course, lost. Napoleon did land two armies in France, but one of them was in Ireland to help the United Irishmen. One of them was wrecked down in Bantry Bay, and the other expedition, the French landed in Mayo, and they marched down, had a number of successes with the Irish.
They did.
And but then ran out of steam, surrendered to an amnesty. The French invading army was treated with huge respect and taken to dinner and so on, and the Irish rebels were treated rather more harshly.
Yeah.
But so there were a lot of people from the rebellion of 98 in New South Wales, including the Wicklow chieftain, as he was called, Michael O'Dwyer. Now, there's a novel for you. he had all the Irish problems. He had Catholic conscience combined with a tendency towards violence, combined with Manichaeism, combined with alcoholism, the stuff that makes up every interesting Irishman. No, you're an interesting...
Nonsense. What are you talking about?
You're an interesting Irishman despite all that. You see, you're
did you bring him?
I'm sorry. I forgot you were here.
We're going to have a talk later, Dad.
That's all right. So, Meg, how did he persuade you into all this?
It was something he'd suggested some years ago, but... I had, for various reasons, wasn't able to. And then in late 2014, he held some pages over the dining room table when I was visiting Mum and Dad, and he said, you know, I've written these 30,000 words. It's something that I'd like to do, but I don't have time. Do you want to have a crack? And I was terrified and at the same time very excited, and I thought, I'll never be able to do it, but... You know, nothing ventured, nothing gained, and I gave it a go. And
but you've been a writer for years, but not fiction, right?
Not fiction. No, I had tried my hand at some fiction, but those efforts deservedly remain in my bottom drawer. I just, you know, I felt that, you know, maybe I just didn't have it. I thought, you know, I might as well give it a go. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work, and no one need be any the wiser, and I can bribe Dad for the rest of his life to keep his mouth shut.
But you seem to love history, so was it the historical side of it that actually made you think, oh, this is something I could maybe do?
It was the having been a journalist, I suppose I'm quite research-driven, so it was... that side of it, and it was just the opportunity to, you know, work with Dad as well, which I thought would be great. And also, you know, just wanting to answer the question for myself about whether I actually could do it or not.
Have people been asking you over the years if you were going to?
Yeah, absolutely.
Follow in his footsteps?
I've had that question a lot, and for a long time I went into the corporate world, and they do say that children rebel, and the children of... lawyers and accountants and actuaries go off and become artists, and clearly the children of artists go off and become corporate affairs people and lawyers and so on.
But you must have observed Tom's practice over the years.
Yeah,
when you were growing up.
Absolutely.
So is it very similar to yours or very different?
I think we're a little bit different simply by virtue of different demands on our time and different lifestyles. So, and it was for a long time a country only he could visit. So he would sort of go behind the study. Having been an incredibly involved father, nevertheless, if he wanted to get anything written at some point, he needed to remove himself from the family maelstrom and, actually right. So while I had been around it all my life, there's a limit to how much of it you can observe, of course. Yeah. But being in the process with him now, it's absolutely wonderful. You know, it was something I never thought would happen, so I'm very grateful for the opportunity. But in terms of our different processes, I think it's more a function of when we each have time and when, you know, I've still got the day job and the kids and who insist on being fed very unreasonably. And,
Meg is a very good mother, takes them everywhere. And we have a lot of our relationship is through your grandchildren, actually.
Your grandchildren.
My grandchildren. Your children, yes.
I'm not that old yet.
I was getting confused. You're my daughter, aren't you?
Yeah. Last time I checked.
And they are parties to this because they go on all the bushwalks where we work out the plots.
Yes,
yeah. And they're tolerant of it.
They're very tolerant. Mum won't walk with us anymore, but the kids are...
It seems like you're creating this sort of Keneally dynasty of writers.
All part of the plan for world domination.
I wanted to create a Keneally dynasty of property developers and brokers and that sort of stuff.
Unfortunately, we don't have that gene.
It seems we're doomed to the circus.
So how does it actually work if you're working out one of the books? Do you go for walks together,
yeah.
Do you?
Yeah. That's yeah, we lovely. Go for long walks and just sort of nut it out, and it's not always set in stone.
We know where they're going to be, because when I first came up with the idea, I thought I had an idea of what convict stations the various episodes would be set in.
Yes.
And so we know where we're beginning, right. and who is the probable victim.
Yeah. And then I go away and write the first couple of drafts in constant contact with Dad. We tried to do the alternating chapters, but it just didn't work. And then Dad reads them, gives me feedback, I incorporate that, and then in the last stage of the process we do what we call dueling computers, where we sit next to each other and, finalise it.
Finalise, which is... delightful, because by then it's quite advanced.
Right. Yeah. So you're not going to step on each other's toes too much at that stage?
No, although we never do. Nobody believes me when I say we don't fight, but there haven't been any pyrotechnics or slammed doors or flung pages or anything of that nature. We're very similar in temperament, so we get along quite well. We're both very conflict averse. So we tie ourselves in knots not to,
wimps.
Start. Yeah. That's a fair call. When there is the occasional genial arm wrestle over minor points, I'm obviously going to give Dad the casting vote because he's done it once or twice.
I'm actually surprised. It doesn't surprise me too much that you get on well together, and I'm actually surprised there's not more collaborations between writers. It seems like I know we're a species of narcissists and egotists, but I had a friend call me up recently and she asked could she use one of my old ideas that I never developed, and I was stoked because she's great and she'll do it much more justice than I ever could. But I'm actually surprised that stuff doesn't happen more often.
I wonder why. I mean, I suppose because of the familiar relationship we're kind of stuck with each other, so we don't have to worry about destroying the relationship. Not that that would ever be in prospect. I think if you tried this with someone with whom you had a problematic relationship, someone would be dead by the end of it.
Or someone who disliked, there are people who dislike people if they're consistently, simperingly understanding. And we would provoke people by being simperingly concessive,
Right, okay.
Well, so the biggest problem is the old problem of, now I hope when you say you're happy with that paragraph, you're not just saying it because you think.
Because I don't want you to think that I feel that, and we can, if we let ourselves, we could go around in circles until we disappeared up certain parts of our own anatomy.
It's one of those things where one of you saying, what do you want to do? No, what do you want
yes.
to do?
Yes, like that's right. Yeah. Right. And that is a tendency we have.
There's not one of you is the taskmaster in this?
No, well, I think we're both taskmasters
she
on ourselves.
She is a taskmaster.
Here we go.
Most yeah. on herself. She's right.
Well, so are you. Otherwise, you wouldn't have managed to write 50 books. You but, can't get to 50 books without being a bit tough on yourself, I shouldn't think.
I always wanted to involve Meg because she writes so much in a sitting. She can write 4,000, 5,000 words in a sitting.
They're not necessarily good words, though,
but
Chris.
Still.
The words that are, you know,
that's
getting out there,
yeah.
getting the words down, as
yes,
you
yes.
know,
is...
Yeah, yep. yeah momentum
Half
is everything
battle,
to
yeah,
me.
Right.
And five, so... She can do, once we've settled on the plot, she can do a first draft in about 6 weeks or something.
And it would take you a lot longer to do that.
It would take me a lot longer. So she's a bit of a phenomenon. And it's like having a kid. When I went to school in 1940, it was in a place called Wauchope in New South Wales. And there were timber getters and dairy farmers who'd send their school kids to school in the school uniform of singlet and khaki pants. And they would come in on horses and they'd have to leave a bit early to go back to do the afternoon milking. So the idea of using your children for labour was lodged in my mind. And when I saw how much Meg could write in a sitting, I thought, wow, I've got to exploit this kid.
I am delighted to be exploited, I must say. It's a wonderful opportunity. I know who's... I feel I'm getting by far the most out of the... He's going to tell me to give myself an uppercut for this, but I feel I'm getting by far the most out of the exchange.
Yes. Where's your Hoodie Menuhin?
I sounds knew like there'd a, be some sort of, yeah.
Sounds like Tom's always been working in his very own little female factory. indentured labourers.
Yes.
But you must be pretty pleased to see your name on the cover of a book.
Oh, it's wonderful, and it's quite surreal. And it's always surreal to me when somebody I've never met has actually read it.
Yeah.
One That's reader extraordinary. Is such a miracle.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many people that won't talk, that they see a writer and they, you know, they naturally shy about coming up and said, I like your book. You've got no idea how much narcissism the writer gets out of that, do they?
That's right. I'm always a little bit embarrassed whenever someone says they've read one of my books. I think, oh, have you? Oh no.
Yeah, yes.
Oh, dear, are you still talking to me? Yeah. No, I know what you mean. I know what you mean, but yeah, so that is extraordinary to see my name on...
Well done, Meg.
Thank you. Thank you. Like I said, the Keneally name is obviously been part of it, but having had... I think one of the only good things about having had manuscripts not back for publication before is that it has shown me that the name isn't everything,
right.
So, yeah.
Well, that's good. That's comforting. Yeah.
And Meg is now... ungratefully writing her own work.
Without adult supervision.
In the dark of night.
Who does she think she is?
Yeah.
How sharper than a serpent's tooth.
Next thing, a Booker Prize, you know. And
hardly, I wish.
And there'll be a picture of us one day that says, Margaret Keneally with some geriatric.
No.
Has there ever been the daughter of a Booker winner? Also in the Booker?
Not as far as I'm
Not
aware.
Yet.
And to be honest, I don't think I have the talent to do it. But maybe my daughter might win the Booker one day.
Well, they've been on the walks, so they're probably getting the bug
exactly.
too, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, they've been absorbing it all. And hopefully they haven't sort of formed a view that you need to be neurotic to be a writer, because they would be forgiven for having formed that view from hanging around Dad and I, but hopefully they are.
Yes, they might become the real estate developers at last.
Or the winners of the 2049 Booker Prize.
Yes, exactly.
And he's off to... We're going to come to questions in a minute, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to prepare one. There's roving microphones. But he's heading off to Van Diemen's Land at the end.
He's off to a place, an island dangling off an island, called Moriah Island off the east coast of Tasmania.
I've been to Moriah Island.
It's a magic place, yes. Isn't it? It's an extraordinary place. And it was the home of a revolutionary called William Smith O'Brien, who was incarcerated there, and we have a character based on him, despite the fact that he was there 20 years, you know, 20 years after the time our book's set. But hey, it's fiction, so we can.
He's the fella whose house at Port Arthur is often pointed out because it's not normally appreciated that these Irish political prisoners. Again, your crowd, you know, that the Irish in America put together funds to rescue them. And that happened right throughout convictism. And they paid a whaler called the Bee to try to rescue William Smith O'Brien from Moriah Island.
Is that right?
And he waded out. He was out in the, you know, up
he was
to his chest
deep,
in the surf. When he was retrieved by the guards. And William, the best escape is Thomas Francis Marr, because when he went to America, he became a newspaper owner, a lawyer, a Union general. He was on the guard, in the Capitol over Lincoln's body, and he was made governor of Montana and killed in Montana, a Van Diemen's Land convict. So they sent a whole group of people to get him out, and they got him as far out of Launceston to an island called Waterhouse Island, which is a little island. And out of the mist one morning, while he's waiting for the Yankee whaler to call in and get him, that's the rendezvous point, he sees a group of... a cutter with a group of people in it, and he thought, they've found me. But no, it's a group of escaped Van Diemen's Land convicts. And they've got a gin locker and a couple of sheep on board, and they have a beach barbie with him overnight. And then they row on to Victoria, where they probably became, their descendants probably became National Party members campaigning for truth in sentencing. But in any case, this wonderful encounter of the convicts on the lam to Victoria, and I do hope they made it, because they were very kind to Thomas Francis Marr, and he escapes. But that was another escape. They sent an agent called Nicaragua Smythe to get a man called John Mitchell out, and they got him to America, and he became the leading Confederate newspaper man in the Confederacy. He split from... There were Irish political prisoners in Tasmania. Most of them fought for the Union, Thomas Francis Marr, but John Mitchell became a Confederate, and his son from Tasmania was killed in Pickett's charge. And they say Australian history's boring.
There's not enough people called Nicaragua, in my opinion. We'll go to questions, ladies and gentlemen. If you want to ask something, the microphones will come to you. I'm not going to choose anyone, they will.
Hello, Meg and Tom. Barney McCusker from Mount Gambier.
Hello.
Hello, Meg. I've brought that bottle for you. You mentioned that the women of the factory got an hour and a half to make up their minds about their prospective husbands.
About an hour.
Let's say an hour. There's a show on Australian television called Married,
exactly.
Married at First Sight,
exactly.
Where they don't even get an hour. Does that mean the people of the 1820s are way ahead of our Australian
TV
network?
They are, and I think their descendants' estates will be suing Channel 9 for breach of copyright any moment now. And most of the time the women did go with the men because they'd do anything to get out of the factory. There was one incident, though, where the man in question was probably a little bit more sensitive than both most of the guys, most of the men who went to the female factory, and most of the contestants on Married at First Sight. And he had a bonnet with him when he showed up to give to his selected woman, and she very much liked the bonnet. The only problem was she didn't like him. So, yeah, that didn't end well. He left bonnetless and womanless.
She had consented after the speed dating, but had second thoughts. But the motivation to get out was considerable, and God knows some of those marriages might have worked better than marriages based on passion. As George Bernard Shaw says in a great document, his introduction to The Devil's Disciple, he says, if you want to be killed, it'll be by someone who loves you. Your best chance of being... it's always the stranger we fantasize about killing us, but it's someone we loved and betrayed that's likely to do it. And secondly, if you want to be saved from a fire or a flood or so on, it's often a total stranger driven by impulses beyond his daily level of nobility.
I've just had an idea for a reality show called A Bonnet for the Bride.
There you go. Wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful.
And men have to bring various types of bonnet along.
Yes, until you find one that meets with the approval.
Hello, Tom. Hi, Meg.
Hello.
I'm a bit overwhelmed, actually. notwithstanding the talk tonight, which has been really great, if I may, I'd like to hark back to Schindler's Ark, because I always wanted to ask you, especially when I was standing in front of his factory in Krakow, which was a wonderful experience, and I've always wanted to ask you your feelings about how the movie completely stripped away that powerful symbolism of the Ark and called it Schindler's List.
Mm.
And it was just one of my favourite books, just to...
Thank you.
Thank you so much for the talk. It's been really great.
Thank you. Yes, it wasn't Spielberg who did that. It was the American publisher who argued for 3 months and said people just think of Noah's Ark. They don't think of the Ark of a Covenant, the Covenant. There being a rough covenant between Oscar and the people who ran his factory, who happened to be Jews, who could then help him rescue other Jews or nominate Jews he should rescue. And he'd do it because he depended on his Jewish technicians and accountants and so on. So there was a covenant, but the publisher at the time said, people won't get that. So we argued for 3 months, and in the end, my agent said, well, you know, it won't create a huge amount of interest, this book, so let's go along with them and call it Schindler's List, and as they want. When Spielberg wanted to make it into a film, my old Jewish mate called me and said, Stephen had the flu and he's reread the book and he's going to make the movie. This was a Schindler survivor that I'd worked with. And I said, Poldek, what will happen when his temperature goes down? God knows what you... Anyhow, I was in California and he asked me to come up. I used to teach, in inverted commas, graduate creative writing at University of California. And my chief pedagogic method was the popular one of serving Australian Chardonnay at my seminars. So I came up and I said, Stephen, would you turn the title back to... Oh, well, that sounds like name-dropping, pretending I called Stephen. But actually, I mean, they're just humans. So I did. And Stephen, would you mind changing it back to its proper title, Schindler's... Ark. And he said, no, I'm not going to, because I want to use lists filmically. Filmically, lists are better than arcs. And he's quite right. And so it was turned into... the movie became Schindler's Ark. I would love to take, before I drop off the perch, to take Meg's kids, who are old enough, to Krakow, and see that factory that Poldek and I had to talk our way into. It was a telephone components factory. It was under martial law when we were there. Solidarity had been outlawed, and so it was very hard to talk our way in. But Poldek, my Jewish mate, did. He was a great talker in Polish and in English. And we got in and saw it, and it's now amazing that it's a museum.
And it wasn't a museum when I was there. It was just out in the Mulga.
So yes. Out in Płaszów, that was the concentration camp from which he took his people. That's outside Krakow, yes. And Spielberg filmed there too, inside a quarry. So it was, Spielberg didn't do a bad job for a kid with learning disabilities. He did have learning disabilities, but he's a nice man. He had one of those mothers who taught him manners, the sort of mother like mine who always said, say thank you. And he always said thank you to actors and to writers and to other people.
Thank you, that was really interesting.
And on that note, we have to say thank you all for coming because our time is up. But thank you all very much for coming. And please thank Tom and Meg Keneally.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.